of home were burning brightly when I left so long ago.
You're listening to Can't Do Nothing With Love, an award-winning short story collection written and read by Ellen Morris Pruitt. Today's episode features Lucky Critters. Marty and I were crossing against the light at the intersection of 3rd and Grant, when for reasons I will never know, Marty, who'd been my big naked guy for just over 2 years, stopped dead in front of an oncoming maroon Bonneville. The car ripped him right from my hand, and the big naked guy became the squashed flat guy. I shouldn't make fun, but that was my love lying there, and I found it easier to think of him flat than the way he really was, all over the asphalt, kind of messy. With only 20 years of my life lived and my big guy already gone, my days were a wreck. My most pressing need, if I wanted to keep our love shack, I had to get myself some employment and rent money. I worked for a while at Gidget's Floral Design, but Gidget said my arrangements lacked grace. I did a stint in Miss Marion's fabric store on Main, but the icky feel of the felt made my skin crawl, so I tried Johnson's Discount Furniture instead. The guys at the store gave me a green apron and let me wait on customers. But after 2 weeks of watching bamboozled black folks fall victim to the store's rent-to-own scam, returning cheap chairs with arms now broken and tables with legs fallen off, only to be told a gazillion payments were still considered due, I folded the apron and handed it back to Mr. Johnson, who did not understand my reasons for leaving. Which is how I ended up at Lucky Critters, a pool hall and grill that's been in downtown Florence, Alabama, ever since my old man was 12 years old, sitting at its counter, smoking illegal cigs. Lucky's the type of place that has to tell you, sign taped to the front door, no alcoholic beverages brought into or off premises. The alcohol is kept in the back by the pool tables, where Marty and I used to shoot 8-ball, beer in ice chests, rocking chair bourbon under the bar if you know to ask for it. I run the counter up front. Our specialty, served only at breakfast, is fried bologna biscuits. And for lunch, it's the triple-decker burger, 3 patties smashed with a spatula on the grill, then stacked high on white bread so soft your fingertips leave dents. The trade sits at the counter, or picks up to-go boxes, with chips, and pays the owner, Miss Lily, at the cash register. We get along, Lucky's and Miss Lily and me, because they expect nothing of me, and I am happy to accommodate them in return. So I was none too glad when the driver of the maroon Bonneville took to coming into the place, sitting at the counter, looking at me sideways out of the corner of his eye. He was that kind of sideways person, sliding onto the stool, staring at the menu board while he ordered, eating his burger with one hand cupped around his plate, hiding the nickels and dimes he left as a tip under his napkin. All of this sidewaysness was unexpected, given the headfirst way he'd plowed over my big naked guy, but I didn't want to overstep. Lucky's might have been his place from way back, or he could have been there just because of me, or he might not even know who I was. So I asked, "You here because of me?" I ripped his ticket from the pad but didn't give it to him, just held it there where he could see it was ready. Tuna salad, iced tea, bag of chips, $4.85, plus tax. His eyes stayed low while he scratched a thin upper lip. I figured his silence answered part of my question. He knew I was the girlfriend, holding onto the big guy's hand when the Bonneville slammed into him. I wasn't wailing. I wasn't splattered with blood. I wasn't hugging a bony mess of a man. But I was all the same the girlfriend. Or I had been. I tapped the ticket against the counter, letting him know I wasn't giving it up until I got the rest of what I wanted. Something of what I was feeling must have communicated itself to Miss Lily, because she looked up from her tallying of receipts, the whirring of the adding machine stilled until she satisfied herself no beer bottles were going to be broken against noggins. Then she resumed with her flying fingers routine. All the while, Mr. Pontiac Bonneville stared at his plate, examining the half-eaten crust of his sandwich, the same dazed look on his face as when he'd circled the wreck site. Circled and circled. "Miss Kelly," he finally said, "your friend, Mr. Martin Howell, lost this." He pushed back from the counter so he could rummage in his pants pocket and lifted a gold chain into the air. He laid its dazzling length onto the counter. The cue ball hit its mark at one of the pool tables. A guy said, "Shit, give me another one." A beer hissed open. It was 12:30, lunchtime. I stuck my fingertip into the arc of the necklace and swirled the chain on the countertop. I'd scraped everything off the dresser looking for it. I'd picked through the toolbox and thrown every little hinge and washer across the room. I'd asked Marty's mom and dad at the funeral, pleaded really, but no necklace. I pried open Mr. Bonneville's hand, which he'd settled there on the counter. Lifting the necklace by the chain, I let it drain into his open palm. The necklace's sorrow weighted against the man's skin by the golden Z. Then I closed his fingers into a fist. "Come with me," I said, and grabbed my wallet and keys from underneath the counter. Calling, "Half an hour." To Lily's lifted eyebrows, I clamped my hand on the man's forearm, led him out the door with his fist balled around my guy's Z. We walked down 3rd Street, the man's not quite short stride matching my not quite tall one, and I held on to his arm. We walked up the hill to the Times Daily offices, their boxy trucks gaping empty of newspapers, and I held on to his arm. We walked past the Community Ed Center and into Cherokee Heights, and still I held on to his arm. Once, just past the newspaper parking lot, I glanced over to see if the man's face betrayed calculation, to see if I was dragging along someone composing a getaway line. But he looked back at me as full frontal as he'd been since the grill of his car knocked and spun my guy while I tried to hold on, and he said, his eyes wider than necessary, "I owe you." I wanted to reassure him, but we had arrived at the Love Shack, so I unlocked the door, then held it open for him to enter. He stepped over the threshold, only to turn and stick out his skinny forearm, as though to re-offer it for grabbing, his fist still closed against the necklace. When I hesitated, he backed into the living room. The drawn curtains filtered the air to dusk, so I started with them. I showed him the hem I'd made in the curtain's fabric when Marty and I had first moved into the place. The hem pricked with blood, because I didn't know how to sew, and Miss Marion's gauze wiggled under my ignorant fingers. I showed him Gidget's flower shop roses I'd saved from our 2nd anniversary, the roses clamped with a clothespin and drying upside down in the closet, their blood red running to their heads. I showed him the Johnson dinette table and chairs, 4 chairs, one with the hopeful booster seat we'd bought on time when things seemed so happy. The man had seen the most important thing, the Z that went with my A, and he needed to see the rest of it. What it had been between the two of us. It wasn't his fault. My Marty had stopped in front of the Bonneville, cocked his head, and listened. To what? The yet-to-arrive screeching of brakes? The sharp intake of breath galloping into our future? The echo of his own voice calling my name? "Lugene!" as he spun and let go of my fingers. I don't know. But not one bit of it had the curved-over, unhappy man standing in my bedroom caused. I tucked open the dresser drawer, lifted the golden A from its cotton. The chain's length dangled in the unused air. I unwrapped the man's fist and poured the 2nd chain inside, its A hitting the angles of the waiting Z, the turns of one letter finding the other's niche, the beginning lining itself up with what might have been. The man closed his fingers over the cuddled chains and nodded like that was that. But I sat him down at the dinette table and showed him pictures of Marty and me, waving, smiling at the camera. I took him through the whole album, told him every little thing I could remember about where we were, what we were doing, who we had been back then. As I flipped the pages, the man's angular body relaxed, and he asked me questions, vague ones at first. What age were we then? Why had I dyed my hair? Then he got bolder, pointed to Marty's ball cap. Was he a Braves fan? By the time he left, I'd given the man not just the 2 necklaces, but Marty's Braves pennant, and his steel-toed shoes, and his 12-foot ladder, and his dop kit, and his framed poster of Lynyrd Skynyrd singing in concert last summer, when we'd gone down at the last minute to the amphitheater and paid half price at intermission, and listened to the words this time, because the members of the band who were left were trying so hard to keep it going, with the others dead and gone. We'd leaned against each other, listening as day turned to dusk, turned to night. After that, the man stopped coming into Lucky's, not, I don't think, because I scared him away, but because it was just done. And while I'm okay with that and everything else, from now on, when I walk to and from Lucky Critters, I won't be crossing the intersection at 3rd and Grant, either with or against the blasted red light. Thanks for listening. Lucky Critters first appeared in print in Peralta Press, the winner of its 2K2 contest. To contribute to Mid-South Peace and Justice, a charity working in the areas of collaboration and nonviolence, please follow the link at can'tdonothingwithlove.wordpress.com or visit midsouthpeace.org. Message me on Facebook at Can't Do Nothing With Love. Our music, The Lights of Home, was written and sung by Mr. Rob Pate. Rock on, Rob.
Oh, he's the light of home. Thank you. Thank you very much.